Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Be future ready with a pension powered by Zurich's award-winning investment performance.
On this August on Drive Time, we're marking the 50th anniversary of events in Northern Ireland and exploring the origins of the Troubles. Tom Donnelly has been to the RTE archives to find out how the themes of 1969 were reported and discussed on radio and television across the past half century. This is Chapter 3.
What kind of Ulster do you want?
We're trying to preserve the Ulster Constitution as set down in the Ireland Act of 1920.
The Reverend Ian Paisley.
That is out of loyalty to the Protestant Revolution of 1688 to 1690.
What kind of Ulster do you want?
Civil rights campaigner Kevin Boyle.
Personally, I was a civil writer, pure and true. That was all. I had no larger agenda on civil rights as a stalking horse for some project for a united Ireland or a republican Ireland or whatever. I was genuinely a person who believed that there should be equality. And I respected the right of the majority, and still do, to determine the question of what state Northern Ireland belongs to.
What kind of Ulster do you want?
If it hadn't been housing or unemployment, other social reasons or political reasons would have been found to stimulate violence.
Unionist politician Bill Craig.
Those who were masterminding this campaign were afraid if they didn't make the most of their opportunity in the late 60s, they would have lost the battle.
What kind of Ulster do you want?
It's not a blame situation.
Bernadette Devlin.
It's an understanding of process so that we don't make mistakes again. But I think we have got to explain how we took the longest, most painful, in terms of human life and in terms of everything out, the most painful route to where we are.
Christmas Eve, 1968, and Terence O'Neill, 5 years on as Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, is writing to a friend, perhaps while listening to a ceremony of carols from St Anne's Cathedral in Belfast on the radio. Boy soprano sings of homelessness, of the want for dignity, of an ox's stall instead of house or hall.
Deny the shabby born, in house and nor in hall, nor in the place of paradise, but in an ox's stall.
In their essential book, Making Sense of the Troubles, David's McKittrick and McVeigh quote from that letter. What a year, O'Neill writes. I fear 1969 will be worse. The one thing I cannot foresee in 1969 is peace. As I look in the glass darkly, I see demonstrations, counter-demonstrations, meetings, rows, and general misery. O'Neill is right. 1969 is widely regarded as the year in which the inevitability of violence and conflict exerted itself in the North. 1969 is the year that destroys O'Neill's own political career, caught between the demands of the minority and a vociferous, at times physical, response by elements of the majority. Northern Ireland is at a crossroads, and on the 9th of December, the Prime Minister goes on television to deliver the address which bears that name.
What kind of Ulster do you want?
O'Neill speaks directly to fellow unionists, to civil rights campaigners, and to the silent masses.
A happy and respected province, in good standing with the rest of the United Kingdom, or a place continually torn apart by riots and demonstrations, and regarded by the rest of Britain as a political outcast. As always in a democracy, the choice is yours.
1 month before, under pressure from London, O'Neill agrees to implement a five-point package of reforms. Many of the changes announced that November derive from the demands of civil rights groups which spring up across the North in the mid to late 1960s. 1963 brings the women of the Homeless Citizens League, including Angela McChrystal.
I was working in a factory with these other girls. I suppose there's nothing else really you can call them, only Protestants. That's where they're Catholic and Protestant here. And most of them were getting married and coming back with their honeymoon into new houses. And where there were several, 60 at least, of us Catholic girls sitting waiting on homes from 10 years onwards and had no chance of getting a house. Well, there was three of us girls, as we called ourselves then, got together, and Mrs. Dunlop, Mrs. Densmore and myself, and we went round the rest of the married couples and got the conditions they were living in and what rent they were paying. And we decided then to form the Homeless Citizens League.
1964, and Con and Patricia McCluskey form the Campaign for Social Justice and run it from their home in Dungannon.
It was good to be able to help. And on our half day, we used to go and visit quite a lot of the people. And then people got the idea that if you could get something like houses for people, you could solve all their problems. So they began to write us pathetic and pitiful letters about all the things that were wrong and all the injustices that were being suffered. And that was why we formed the Campaign for Social Justice in Northern Ireland. And all we ever wanted to really fix was a house letting on a point system, one man, one vote. Jobs.
Patsy McCooey, founder of the Tyrone Democrat newspaper, calls this move the single most important in the genesis of the civil rights movement. In April 1967, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association formally comes into being with its demands for one man, one vote, an end to gerrymandering, prevention of discrimination in the allocation of housing and jobs, and an end to both the Special Powers Act and the reviled B specials. And in February 1968, the Derry Housing Action Committee arrives, who, led by young radicals like Eamon McCann, stage a series of protests and sit-in throughout the summer.
The caravan got me involved.
Eamon McCann with Miriam O'Callaghan last year. In June 1968, Eamon arrives home in Derry from London, where he's been living.
On the first day I was there, the first evening, I was walking along Rossville Street and I met my old friend Dermy McLenaghan. Dermy said, "We're pulling a caravan onto the road over here. Will you give us a hand?" And off we went. There was a couple with four children living in a caravan which was parked up a mucky lane in the Brandywell area of Derry. All the children were ill and they couldn't get a house. And the reason, or one of the reasons they couldn't get a house is that they were Catholic. So we pulled the caravan out into the middle of the Lecky Road and kept it there for 24 hours. We started with maybe, 15 people. It was a small group of us that lugged this caravan out. After 24 hours of keeping it there, we had maybe 100. I forget the exact numbers, but it was much swollen. So we took it back again and took it out the next weekend for 48 hours. And now, we have a few hundred people. And I remember it was at that moment that some of us turned to one another and thought, we're on to something here, this could work.
In July, Prime Minister O'Neill dismisses the demands of the campaigners and, like many unionists, questions who they represent.
These people do not care about all our wonderful achievements, all our wonderful new factories, which are employing all the people of Northern Ireland today. Men such as these, brethren, do not speak for Ulster. I doubt indeed whether they even speak for the people who they pretend to speak for.
Groups begin to coalesce. New kinds of action begin. In August, the first march takes place with a small group walking the 4 miles between Coal Island and Dungannon behind a banner which reads simply, Civil Rights. Among them is local 21-year-old Bernadette Devlin, by now a psychology student at Queen's University.
I remember tootling along and it was fun and we got there. And
to
the thing
Dungannon,
is, to Dungannon, that's where I went to school. Mm. It never occurred to you as you walked along the Coleyland-Dungannon road that when you got to Dungannon, you wouldn't be allowed in.
You got to the top of the hill to the roundabout.
Mm-hmm.
And what was at the roundabout?
Because we were near the back of the march, what was at the roundabout was lots of people in front of us. So word is filtering back. We have stopped here because we're not allowed into the square.
There was a police cordon.
Police were stopping you. There was negotiations going on. And all of this was new to us. What, you know, what do you mean you're not allowed into the square?
Why not?
Because you're Catholics. Because you're a demonstration. Because you're complaining. And we're foot soldiers. Yeah. We're not in charge of this. And I distinctly remember Jerry Fitt promising to lead us through the barricades. The number of promises that I remember being made by leaders that were never, you know. Jerry was going to lead us over the barricades, but that didn't happen. We convened where we were. Betty Sinclair spoke. Erskine Holmes
Communist
spoke.
Parties, Labour Party.
Jerry Fitt spoke. I think
in some ways, every political eccentric in Northern Ireland was there.
They weren't considered eccentrics at the time.
In Dungannon and across the north, unionist and loyalist opponents of the civil rights protesters stage counter-demonstrations, often in the hope of thwarting the marches. Within days of the first march, planning begins for another demonstration, this time in Derry. Members of both NICRA and the Derry Housing Action Committee work together to lay the groundwork for an October event. But on the 1st of October 1968, the Apprentice Boys of Derry announced their intention to hold a march along the same route, at the same time, on the same day. In response, Bill Craig, then Home Affairs Minister, bans the civil rights demonstration. The civil rights divide, with NICRA delegates advising care, caution, cancellation. But the march goes ahead.
RUC water cannon standing by. The feeling here is that one of three things can happen.
RTE's reporter before, during and after is Pat Sweeney.
The marchers could merely gather and, when stopped by the police, withdraw peacefully, postponing their planned rally in the Diamond for a week. The police, on their part, could allow the parade to take place and prosecute selected marchers later. The third alternative seems to be a head-on clash between the marchers and the large force of police drafted in for the occasion. Here is Mr. Brendan Hines, chairman of the local Labour Party branch.
The Londonderry Labour Party will march regardless of Mr. Craig's ban, the police, or come what may, we will march hell or high water, LMS station, to the Diamond, or as far as we possibly can, regardless.
If the police don't let you through peaceably, will you then abandon the march?
I personally can't be held responsible for what will happen at the barrier, because we will be taking children, women and children, to the march, because it's in their interest that we're doing this. It's for the sake of our city and the future.
The RUC informs marchers they cannot enter certain areas.
Any person who wishes to parade or hold the meeting is quite at liberty to do so, provided he holds it other than in an area specified in the order.
Through megaphone diplomacy, Ivan Cooper insists that civil rights have no desire for violence.
We are demanding home, employment, freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. We do not wish bloodshed or violence.
Violence comes. Marchers are batoned by RUC members. Pat Douglas's screams of pain carry across the world. Gentlemen, please, for God's sake. People begin to fight back in self-defense. Riots break out across Derry. Protesters exchange stones and bottles for the batons and water cannon of the police. Police raid homes in the Bogside. From here on, the focus will be on Derry.
A young constable told me, "You go in there at your own risk." I walked down Butcher Street over a jagged carpet of broken glass. Every shop window in the street was broken. At Butcher Gate, at least 50 police were dodging stones hurled by crowds in Fawn Street. Our photographer Gay O'Brien was told, put that light out. Helmeted constables brandished batons at his cardiganed figure.
These scenes in Derry, captured by that cardiganed cameraman from RTE, change minds, change attitudes, change history.
Someone like Gay O'Brien in RTE and his camera work, they'd already internationalised the situation.
After Derry, some of the more radical members of the movement found People's Democracy, among them Bernadette Devlin, Eamon McCann and Michael Farrell. And while Terence O'Neill has praise for NICRA, he has less time for the young radicals of PD.
Obviously, far the most significant thing was the civil rights movement, and in effect it achieved more in a few months than I thought could have been achieved in a few years. And I paid a tribute, while I was still Prime Minister, I paid a tribute to the civil rights movement, which everybody thought, or every unionist thought, was a rather crazy thing for me to do. But I was really praising them in comparison, I think, with the People's Democracy that I didn't have a very high regard for.
Despite the risks of violent reaction, People's Democracy resolves to begin 1969 with a march from Belfast to Derry.
The march to Derry was modelled quite specifically on a march from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama in 1965.
20 years later, Michael Farrell tells Pauline Ní Chiaráin about the inspirations for that march.
Which was a long cross-country march, which was much criticised by some of the more moderate elements in the civil rights movement at the time, which was attacked by the police as it set off, and very viciously and brutally attacked. It focused an enormous amount of international attention on the situation in Alabama, and it forced the federal government to intervene. Now, we intended the March to Derry to do exactly that. We intended it to go across country. It would last for 4 days. It would attract an enormous amount of media attention, well, enormous in Northern Ireland terms, which it did. It went through areas that had been untouched by the civil rights movement before that, and it mobilised people there. The violence of the state's forces attacking us, well, of loyalist vigilantes attacking us with the collusion of the police, which is very similar to the situation in America where white Ku Klux Klan supporters attacked the Selma march with the assistance of state troopers. That demonstrated the sectarian nature of the state and the inability of the Northern Ireland government, inability or unwillingness, didn't matter, to confront the sectarianism of their own supporters and to do anything about the situation. And we thought it would force the British government to intervene over their heads and to grant the demands of the civil rights movement.
So did you want to provoke it?
No, we didn't want to provoke anything, because there was nothing provocative in what we were doing. We were a bunch of completely non-violent demonstrators. I mean, it's not that we were pacifists, but it was a tactical question. We absolutely decided there's going to be no violence from our side.
The march attracts the attention Farrell and his comrades desire, but it also attracts less desirable attention, like that of Loyalist leader Major Ronald Bunting. And again, Loyalism determines to deploy its increasingly successful tactic to thwart the march.
You are, by implication there, saying that the counter-demonstrations of our people cause violence. This is not true.
Because this man's from Erra, he's bound to say that.
Yes, he'd not go back home again if he didn't.
Will you be attempting to stop the march in any way, though, Major Bunting?
Well, now, William, you know me well enough, and I have given a request to the loyal citizens of Ulster, and thank God they've responded. I thank you very much, indeed, to hinder it and harry it. And I think they've hindered it, and I think you would agree, to a certain extent, they've harried it.
Northern Ireland's season of O'Neillite goodwill collapsed in a bloody orgy last week in the streets and roads of Derry City and County.
A young Rodney Rice reports for RTE on what happened.
The cudgel-clutching Paisleyites demanded and drew the blood of their opponents. The RUC proved, finally, that they either couldn't or didn't want to do their job for which they're paid, the maintenance of peace. And, for the first time, the civil rights leaders lost control of their supporters as Derry fell into a state of virtual civil war. It began in the roads through the Fair County Antrim when Major Bunting's loyal citizens of Ulster harassed some 60 members of the student-organised People's Democracy as they marched towards Derry. On Wednesday, only 6 hours after the marchers left Belfast, they found themselves facing a group of stern-faced extremists who occupied a bridge to block the entry to Antrim town. After 3 hours' confrontation, the students accepted police transport through the town to their overnight quarters. Again, on Thursday, their road into Randallstown was blocked and they were unable to march to Toom. That night, they stopped short of Maharaa. While in the town, 1,000 Paisleyites controlled the streets. The police were outnumbered, and the extremists broke shop windows, besieged journalists in a hotel, and stopped traffic to ask drivers their religion. Two cars were overturned. Presumably, the occupants gave the wrong answer. On Friday, the marchers gave up their attempt to walk through Maharaa. At Dungiven, they at last refused to accept police rerouting and broke a cordon to head for Clody. No batons were used on them. Meanwhile, in Clody, rival Protestant and Catholic groups were fighting. But it was on Saturday that the cauldron exploded. Four times the students were ambushed on that last 10 miles to Derry. At that first ambush, a terrible battle at Burntollet Bridge, some of the marchers concluded that the police had led them in intentionally and then showed little interest in protecting them. The extremists attacked from both sides and from the front. They came from the high ground at the sides of the road and from hiding below the bridge. Certainly, police reconnaissance appeared to underestimate the strength of the opposition. One marcher claimed to have overheard an officer tell a loyalist, "Get them at the crossroads." Armed Protestants chased the right's walkers as they fled across the fields. They smashed the heads of men and girls alike. At Altnagelvin, at Irish Street, at Spencer Road, further ambushes awaited. Twice, police charged the extremists. By the time the march reached the Guildhall, 87, including six police, had received hospital treatment.
These events and the ambush on the bridge at Burntollet are seen as central to the descent into conflict.
I don't know if it's fair, but they will blame Burntollet for what subsequently, for the Provo campaign subsequently.
30 years later, Maureen de Bourke tells Dermot Ferriter about a narrative which emerged later that Burntollet started the troubles.
The idea was that very gradually you would bring right-minded, fair-minded unionists along with you on the principle that people were being discriminated against, goddammit, and they weren't being properly represented, and there was gerrymandering, and that it would be a very gradual thing. There'd be no violence involved. People would see the rightness of the cause, and all of this would be achieved, and that it would be a stepping stone, perhaps, way down the road to United Ireland. Well, Burntollet stopped that dead in its tracks because it polarised the people straight away. It may have happened anyway. As I say, I don't know whether it's fair to blame the People's Democracy or Burntollet, but in any way, it snookered that plan. It facilitated the provosts who, from the word go, wanted a military campaign, who wanted a fight, and the rest is history.
But at this point, even Seamus Mallon believes that war is a real prospect.
People, I don't think, realise how close we were to a civil war in certain parts of the north of Ireland. It was tipping that way for a considerable length of time.
Can we hear it in these archive interviews? Is violence raising her voice? Frustration, anger, determination certainly are. The day after Burntollet, People's Democracy leaders are in the RTE This Week studio alongside survivors of an older Ireland, Ernest Blyde and Padraig O'Donnell.
Tom McGuirk and Bernadette Devlin and John McGuffin. May I start with you, John?
A large number of peaceful demonstrators were viciously beaten up and did not retaliate. Nonetheless, we're not martyrs. What we are trying to do is show up the situation for what it is. In point of fact, what we have had is police harassment, we have had police lies, we have had the police leading us into an ambush yesterday. The government have got to do something about the situation, about controlling counter-demonstrators. We have no particular hatred for the Paisleyites, but we don't regard the people who did it as our enemies. Many of the people who came out and attacked us need jobs and houses just as badly as the people who were marching.
As late as here, January 1969, many Irish politicians, including those from not very far south, appear disengaged.
Is it not a bit excessive to suggest bringing in the army in the United Nations?
It's not.
Which, after all, is only a bit of a riot.
I don't want him to bring in the army or the United Nations.
He could a prolonged
the police
bit of a riot.
Who were there without any extra police, the police who were there could have dealt with it quite capably if they had had the mind to or the orders to.
Derry at the moment is in a state of chaos, and Belfast has been in a state of chaos, and now we've heard that Fermanagh are planning a march for next week, and this thing is going to spread all over Northern Ireland. Unless they put their foot down soon, there's going to be very, very serious trouble.
Yes.
And this would be a justification for bringing the army.
The situation in the north will never go back to what it was before you people started your agitation.
No, Northern Ireland will never go back to the way it was before. And in the RTE studios that Sunday afternoon in 1969, an RTE soon to be bombed by the UVF, Bernadette Devlin signposts the direction we'll take at the same time next week.
I personally can see the movement has now been taken to Derry. The people of Derry now realise that the power is with them. Only they, the population, can save the situation.
Bernadette Devlin, ending chapter 3 of All This Happened. Tom Donnelly produced. Check out rt.ie archives for more historical recordings from RT.